Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. An Oregon sheriff says he'll meet today with leaders of the armed group occupying the federal wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon. That is our first topic as we review the week's big news this hour with Washington State Representative Matt Manweller, Republican from Ellensburg. Welcome, Representative.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming. Democratic City Council member Deborah Juarez from Seattle's 5th District. Nice to see you again.
Yay, go D5.
D5. And from the Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter. Good to see you, Joni.
Good afternoon.
So the governor of Oregon calls the occupation of the wildlife refuge unlawful, instigated by outsiders, and she says it has to end. The question is how. Let's start with you, Representative Manweller. Should police raid the Malheur Wildlife Refuge?
No, I think that would just escalate what is generally a symbolic protest. I would just let them have their say. Nobody's using the building right now. It's the dead of winter in the middle of nowhere, and we don't want another Ruby Ridge or Waco. That just turns them into martyrs.
Would you have said the same thing if these were armed American Muslims?
Well, you know what? Not only would I say the same thing, but we have in the past. I often remind people who are kind of getting over the top on this issue is that America has a long history with this type of protest. In the 1960s, African American students seized ROTC buildings and campuses throughout America, and those are American military institutions. In the 1970s, Native Americans seized Alcatraz, which is a federal penal institution, and they were doing so because they wanted to raise awareness about grievances they had. And, you know, we didn't storm the ROTC and shoot these African American students. We didn't storm Alcatraz and shoot Native Americans. We let them have their say, and then they peacefully went away. And I think that's what will happen here.
So just wait them out. Turn off the power. What happens? What do you do?
Well, you know, I think they'll, you know, there's always consequences to civil disobedience. I mean, we should remember that Rosa Parks did get arrested, right? Martin Luther King did spend time in jail. I mean, the nature of civil disobedience is that if you have the courage to engage in civil disobedience, you better be prepared to accept the consequences. So I think that there will be some charges of trespassing or whatever, you know, the local sheriff.
Before there are charges, there's got to be some kind of confrontation, right? I'm just wondering why. What are the police doing? And I do want to hear from my.
You know, I don't know. I'll leave that to local law enforcement to decide. They're trained on these type of issues.
True.
But, again, I don't think provoking this into a Ruby Ridge or a Waco issue is the best solution.
Councilmember Juarez, any different perspective on this?
Absolutely. I think all deference to you, sir. I don't think you can compare this to civil disobedience in any way, shape, or form in the struggle for African Americans and civil rights. And my people, Native Americans, we are fighting for health care, education, being discriminated against. You have a bunch of disgruntled farmers, and I'm going to frame it the way I think it should be framed. This is public land. And the Paiute people in 1879 were removed from this land. So if anyone has a right to that land, if anyone should be pissed off, it should be them. So that's my concern. Second of all, I don't think we're being emotionally or intellectually or historically honest about what public lands are and what this means and what are these people angry about. I don't even know what they're mad about. So I don't see this in the real narrative of civil disobedience. I think that there's some amnesia here that people don't want to remember that before this became public lands, it was Indian country and it was taken from the Paiute people forcibly and they were taken off their land. And in Indian country right now, all over Indian country today, and of course on Facebook, everyone's posting what's going on. And Indian people after Alcatraz, we didn't just go away. That was part of the American Indian movement, AIM, and that was part of the civil rights movement. And they are not the same, categorically not the same.
Well, you know, I think that that's one of the benefits of having a show like this is that you bring different perspectives together. I understand that probably people who are born and raised and lived in Seattle don't understand what these people are angry about. But those of us who live in rural areas, we know exactly what they're angry about. And if I may, I would like to read just one sentence from the federal district judge that had the Hammonds case. And this is what a very reasonable, well-educated, moderate.
This is the Hammonds was the ranchers that were.
He said in his decision, in his written decision, over the past two decades, government officials and perhaps others entered into a literal, intentional conspiracy to deprive the family not only of their permits, but also of their vested water rights. This behavior shocks the conscience. I want you to think about that. A federal district judge in his opinion, says the behavior of the government is so bad that it shocks the conscience. That's a phrase that judges only use in the most egregious situations. So these are people who were not being defended by their government. They were being attacked by their government, a conspiracy to deprive them of their rights, their water, their land. Of course they're upset. And they've chosen the only means that they have available to get any attention.
Let's not get too wild-eyed in their defense here. Let's talk about what has happened here. So in the case of the Hammonds, there is a sort of egregious kind of sentencing that went on. I'll concede that point. But these are not sort of these folks have in the earlier standoff were pointing guns at federal agents. You know, these folks don't pay their grazing fees. We do have rules around here, and you're supposed to follow them.
Well, the
and
Bundys,
then after the last
the Bundys
stand,
didn't pay their grazing fees,
and after the last
did.
Stand, and after the Bundys, and after the last, but the Bundys are the ones that are at the Malheur Refuge. They're the ones that are there. The son is. So once you get to this whole business here, you think of what happened originally with the first standoff here in 2014. You know, that sort of dissipated, but no one was prosecuted. No one paid grazing fees, and off we went. So now you have another round, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I'm not for storming it. Heck no, that doesn't make any sense. They should probably, you know, let it dissipate, turn off the heat, turn on the heat, whatever they decide about all of that. But in the end, if there's something to prosecute, so this just doesn't become like a thing we do all the time, just when we feel like
it. I think I should add something about the Hammonds, though. As far back as the 1980s, they were giving death threats to these people. Exactly. What they were doing is they were allowing their cattle to go, and they didn't want Department of Land Management putting up fences because they put letting their cattle come into a canal where they had no business being, and they didn't want them putting up fences. So since the 80s, they were giving death threats against federal people. Now, you're going to tell me that since 1980 up until now, more than once, not only death threats to the federal agents and the federal employees, to their children.
You know, in the time we have, what I want to focus on is the larger dispute that this group wants to end federal control of Western ranch lands. Councilmember Juarez said, why aren't we talking about returning it to the people who owned it before the federal government did? What do you say, Representative?
Well, you know, history doesn't work that way. I mean, I guess it goes because there's an ad infinite regression, right? I mean, should the Canadians give land back to the French because of some other war, or should, you know, maybe the...
So history is written by the winners?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can't go back and rewrite history forever. But I think the question here that Joni asked was questioning is what should come of this, right? Do we just have this be a protest, or do we reform our practices where people who live in rural areas can earn a living ranching, farming, grazing without being turned into criminals? Can we have environmental protection of the land without a bureaucracy like the Bureau of Land Management or the EPA that is abusive to its own citizens? So my hope is that what comes of this is reform.
What kind of reform? What do you want to see?
Well, I think that we have to rein in the unelected bureaucracy. Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, also a very well-known liberal, wrote a powerful dissent about how the unelected bureaucracy, particularly the Bureau of Land Management, and I think her term was they kill people by the death of a thousand cuts, and they're not accountable to anybody. Our names show up on a ballot. These people's names never show up on a ballot, so they.
But
can
couldn't
do whatever
why don't they lobby their elected members of Congress to return federal land to the states? They have.
They are. And that is okay. I've been personally lobbied about that. I know that local federal representatives have been lobbied about that. I think that is a movement, and we might get some direction that way.
Okay. So that's where you would go. Congressional reform.
Well, no, I would say administrative reform, not congressional reform, but congressional reform of the way unelected bureaucracies behave.
Yeah, but once you get to this point of giving the land back, who are you going to give the land back to? Because you're going to say to the people who are working the land or to the Native Americans who lived there before? That is a whole can of worms. It seems to me that the federal management of that land is the better way to keep it going as this protectorate for bird sanctuary.
Last word on this, Deborah Juarez.
I'm going to quote Cher, if I could turn back time.
Hmm.
Yeah. No, we're not talking about turning back time. And we're not talking about going back into history, but what we are saying is that you have to look at the history and be honest about it. If you're talking about who owns this land, public lands and how it's managed. I don't think it's fair. I think what these people are doing is illegal. They shouldn't be in there. And if they're doing death threats since the 80s and nothing's happened to them, if something finally did, I don't know what they're angry about. They have their guns, they got their property, and they had their cattle in these. And I did not grow up in Seattle. I grew up on the Puyallup Reservation. I'm a member of the Blackfeet Nation, 1.3 million acres in Montana, all rural. Come from a long family of ranchers, represented my tribe, so I understand the rural nature of all of that and grazing and ranchers and what that means. So I'm not speaking like some city girl.
We've been talking about this continuing standoff in Oregon. The Oregon sheriff and Harney County sheriff says he's going to meet today with the leaders of this armed group occupying the federal wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon. We've got more news to cover this hour on KUOW's Week in Review. City Councilmember Deborah Juarez from Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter, State Representative Matt Manweller from Ellensburg with us. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. Reviewing the big news of the week and trying to figure out what we can do about it. This week, the mother of the so-called affluenza teenager appeared in court. Tanya Couch and her son, Ethan, ran to Mexico while he was on probation after killing four people in a drunken driving wreck. The teenager's lawyers famously claimed that he suffered from affluenza. This means the unhealthy and contagious pursuit of wealth, and the term was popularized by a Seattle writer, John DeGraff, in a PBS documentary, in a book. And I talked to DeGraff this week. He reminded us that affluenza, in his opinion, is not just a disease of the rich. You're sick, too, if you're chasing the dollar.
A lot of studies that show, for instance, that if you have a materialistic orientation toward life, that is, if your goal in life is to have more money and more stuff, you will be less happy than people whose goal in life is service, is caring, is connection, and all of those things. The psychological studies on that are numerous, and they always come to the same conclusion. And yet somehow our society doesn't get that, and we seem to believe that wealth is the goal. To me, that is about the most myopic and stupid goal for society I can imagine.
Is wealth the stupidest goal there is? And if so, what can you do about it? Republican State Representative Matt Manweller, how myopic and stupid is the pursuit of wealth?
Well, I think it's neither and neither. I mean, if your goal is to pursue poverty, then I would suggest that you travel around the world a little bit and maybe talk to some people who experience poverty firsthand.
You think he's advocating
as a goal?
You really think he's advocating poverty?
No, but I think he is maybe taking it a little too far. All societies, all communities, whether they're impoverished minority communities, whether they're impoverished immigrant communities, all come to the United States because they want to lift themselves out of poverty. They want an opportunity to have more than their more for their children than they had. I don't think that we should belittle that or call it a disease. I don't think there's affluenza. I think that's too. I would call this the Paris Hilton syndrome. This kid's a trust funder. He's never asked to do any work that required a callus. He's handed everything on a silver platter, and he's a spoiled brat. And I think we should just call it for what it is and not worry about the political correctness.
Are you saying Paris Hilton's a spoiled brat, or this author John DeGraff is
a
spoiled
Paris Hilton, spoiled brat. I don't know the author at all.
Okay,
comments on him.
I think the biggest outrage, of course, is that the affluenza brat, to use your term. I mean, this is the most.
Oh, we're talking about the teenager, right? Ethan Couch.
The most jive defense you could ever imagine. And somehow, because they had so much money, his mom and dad didn't have time to teach him the difference between right and wrong. I mean, that just makes no sense. That is the most ridiculous
thing. He grew up without consequences, therefore without borders. That's the affluenza.
That is the argument, but it's a jive one. It doesn't explain what happened.
Yeah, I agree.
He mowed down four people. Let's say, and if he didn't learn it then, now he's off partying in Puerto Vallarta. Oh, my gosh.
I agree with Joni. I am just floored. It's an indictment against our criminal justice system, and particularly Texas, that you can have this as a defense. It took us 25 years to have the battered women's defense as an affirmative defense when women were beat up. And they wouldn't allow us to have it when I was a public defender and a judge. Do you know how many women have been in prison for being battered, didn't have that as an affirmative defense, where the courts and the Anglo system wouldn't recognize that was a legitimate defense? But yet in Texas, you can come in and say you're a rich white kid and I didn't know any better. And just like that, it gets to be a defense, and you got to kill four people. I'm just floored by that.
And beyond this teenager, do you have any concerns about affluenza in this country, that we're chasing the dollar too much?
Okay, I got to say two things about whether
in your life.
Chasing the dollar too much. First of all, affluenza has been going on forever. It's just now happened to be an affirmative defense in Texas. I think what we are seeing, which I'm seeing at my age now, is that people now are just becoming hoarders of their money. They're just collecting it. They're not investing in capital. They're not giving it back to their community. They're not being more philanthropic. I can never say that word right. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it's a whole different version of capital.
But why would you think people aren't investing their money in capital?
Because
isn't
when
that
you
the
see,
stock market is?
When you see how much a CEO gets paid, and you see what a worker gets paid, and you see what it looks like in 1980 and now, there's like a 500% difference in what a worker gets paid and what an owner of a business does. And that old model of, you know, no, we got to give money to the business owners because they create jobs. That used to be true 25 years ago. That's not true now. It just simply isn't. Particularly with Wall Street and how the market works, and with the different tools that we use, what we call any model of investing that we're using now.
Well, I'd have to disagree with that. I mean, the economic data suggests that still to this day in the United States, 90% of all job growth comes from small businesses under 50 employees or more. So small employees are still the primary job generator in the United States. And, obviously we've actually democratized Wall Street in the last 20 years. Things like Ameritrade and the internet have allowed your middle class and even lower middle class people to participate in an economic system that once was exclusively for the rich. So,
and is that a complete unalloyed good, or does that give even more people a chance to obsess about money more than they did?
Absolutely,
before.
It's a good. Why should we have a stock market where only 1% of Americans have access to earn capital, earn income and wealth by investing in capital? That should be available to everybody.
Well, yeah, that's fair. I ask because I'm still curious about this larger question of heard Representative Manweller basically say affluenza is. Deborah Juarez says it's been around forever.
And
Manweller says it's a sort of the idea that that's a disease is a fiction. Joni?
And I heard your larger interview with John DeGraff, and you were asking, so when do you know you have affluenza?
Right.
You know, like
great
you
question.
Sneeze or, you know, what happens basically?
Spot.
And you were asking that you were talking about, you know,
cramps.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I go to work, my kids have three meals a day, and but if I yearn to go to Hawaii, am I now afflicted?
Basically, a middle class American who wants more, is that affluenza?
No, I think that this term came about and now is being somewhat overused.
Mm-hmm.
That this term came about in this ridiculous defense that transpired, and now we're all
well.
Supposed
it
to
came
ask
about
ourselves.
In this PBS movie and
right.
book about that he's claiming it's a problem, and we're
that we all
we're
have
sick.
It because you dared to say you wanted to go to Hawaii, and I think that would
no.
Be okay.
John DeGraff actually said no, he doesn't consider that affluenza, and I was pushing back saying, well, let's think big picture here. If I'm a middle class American by most measures. I think I have enough. I'm a king. So I'm just trying to get at how do you know when your priorities, you don't, the fish in the water, right? The fish doesn't know it's in water. It's just what it does. You go to work and you invest and you maybe you work extra hours, whatever you're. And we don't always know what drives us and whether that's healthy for us. So that's my question is, can you feel like, yeah, I'm doing about the same thing as my neighbor is, but how do you know whether you're myopic and stupid, as you said, and you ought to live life for some other reason?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's an individual decision. I
yes.
mean, whether this is the Puritan work ethic or whether it's the keeping up with the Joneses, which is a term we used in the 70s, or whether it's affluenza. But I mean, I think my broader sense is that every individual has the right to set their own priorities. For myself,
yes.
I wanted to be a teacher. When I decided to be a teacher, I knew that meant $50,000 salaries and not $200,000 salaries. Some people choose to be a public defender. You could have been a corporate attorney. We made choices about lifestyle versus affluenza. And as long as everybody gets to make that decision on their own, I don't care.
So maybe calling it a disease is overwrought because you're saying...
That's bugging me. It's bugging me, and you said it very well, that it's individualized. It's individualized. As long as you know right from wrong, you can proceed, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know what our listeners think, by the way. Facebook, KOW Public Radio, or tweeting at KOW.
I think that it comes down to, and I'll use these terms, economy of scale. You can live in a rural community, like you could live on my reservation in Montana on 40, 50,000, even 30,000. You'd be wealthy. You'd be okay. I think it's your value system. I think it what it means to you. And I know from the reservation and the people I grew up with, if your kids are healthy, if you're healthy, if you have a job, if you have heat and you can provide food, you're doing good. And, you know, and so when you see people who want more, 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 you're right. It is, it's always been there. And it will. And you don't want to judge, like you were saying. I think you're right. It's an individual choice. But what you were saying is a very good question. You know, when does it, like you said, when does it get too much? When is it ugly?
When is it ugly?
Yeah.
How do you answer that?
I think it's ugly when you get bloated and you have so much and you walk by people who are homeless, or you don't care about people who don't have health care, or you don't care about whether or not people can pay their light bill, or you want to blame people for being poor, or you want to blame people for being homeless, or you want to criminalize behavior because you find it distasteful that someone has to sleep in a doorway. That's when I think it gets ugly. You become blind.
Then I'll give the last word to you, Republican Manweller. Is that an ugliness? All the things she just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when your pursuit of wealth is done in a manner that is unethical, that intentionally harms others, is you're cheating to get it, then I think you've crossed the line. I think that, you know, the councilwoman is right in the sense that we should not necessarily criminalize poverty, although I do think that there are quality of life issues where people would say, you know, I don't want a tent city where my kids will be walking by, you know, maybe hypodermic needles or something along those lines. So we have to find that balance between not criminalizing poverty, but also saying that we do have the right as a civic community to set standards for the community that we want to live in.
We've been talking about affluenza again because the mom of this so-called affluenza teenager, Ethan Couch, is back in court. He's still in Mexico. And you're listening to KOW's Week in Review. On a related topic, we're going to ask, what does it mean when people keep saying Seattle is losing its soul? What is soul? What is Seattle's soul? And what should we do about it, if anything? Stay tuned. We're going to talk about gun control in a moment, but have any of you ever felt like you came to the end of a long book and it was so good, and then the ending so let you down that you held a grudge against that author? Like, how did you do that to me?
Well, it sounds like a marriage, but
sounds like marriage.
I'll let that one go.
Well, we're going to help you avoid that. We're going to help you avoid that feeling because we are on KUOW. We're hooking you up with the author of Book Lust, Nancy Pearl. Nancy wants to know the last great satisfying read that you had, a book that paid off, a book you loved, and why you loved it. That actually is very important. Why did you love it? And the reason she asks is she wants to help lead you to your next great book based on what worked for you. So I'm asking you, the listener, to give us a call and leave us a message about the last book you loved and why. It's 206-221-3663, okay? 206-221-3663. Tell us the last book you loved and why, and based on that, Nancy Pearl will guide you as to what to read next.
Wow.
Good idea.
Cool.
Good as Uber.
Okay. She'll drive you right there. 206-221-3663. And welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. Deborah Juarez, Matt Manweller, Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. Reviewing the week's news, and this week President Obama said he will move to increase the number of gun purchases that have to go through a background check, which is where the buyer's name is run through a database to see if he or she is allowed to buy a gun. The president is stuck between his desire for more regulation of guns and Congress's opposition to that. Joni, what's the right solution?
Well, I don't know that it's the right solution, but here's what I think is actually going to happen. In addition to the things that the president is trying to do, what I think is going to happen is that you're going to begin to see other states and other localities similar to Washington State and the city of Seattle doing this on their own. Public opinion is moving way faster and has already been quite strong on simple things like background checks. That's just so wholesome. I don't know where to start. But if you think
or burdensomely regulating,
or
depending on your point of view.
Not in my view. So you take something like Initiative 594, which passed here recently, background checks in Washington State. If you remember the campaign, so much money came in on the side of background checks that the NRA sort of just laid down and said, okay, we'll either win that in court. But the fact is the voters wanted it, and you will see other states replicate that because that's what the voters want. It has to be citizen initiative states. Not all of them do that. And sometimes you'll see legislatures, and sometimes you'll see local jurisdictions do what the city of Seattle did, which is put the tax on guns and ammunition enough to and also sort of change the way we talk about it. Talk about it as a public health matter, which of course it is. Some of the things that happen with guns, if those things happen with like refrigerators or swimming pools, oh my gosh, you know, you'd see action on that, and that is the new way. So I think the local entities are gonna rule the day on this as time goes on.
Ellensburg State Representative Matt Manweller, you agree? Voters, not federally, it's not happening in Congress, but it's going to happen state by state. We're going to regulate guns more.
Yeah, I think that Joni's right in her empirical analysis of what will happen, that people will run recalcitrant legislatures if they feel the need. In the long run, I have to say, I wish the president the best of luck. I wish our governor the best of luck. I have two children. I don't want gun violence anywhere else myself. But I do think this is much ado about nothing. You know, we talk about 594, and I'll tell you right now, in a year since the passage of that law, not one prosecution, not one filing, not one transfer prevented, not a single government entity in the state of Washington has used that law in any capacity. So did it make us, was it a feel-good measure? Yeah. Did we spend a lot of money debating gun control? But is the world one iota different today after the passage of that bill and before? And the uncomfortable answer is absolutely not.
Let me tell you some more about that. We're talking about the background check law that Washington voters approved about a year ago. No reports of arrests or prosecutions. The FBI says more than 4,500 private sale background checks were conducted between March and November. The FBI doesn't report how many of those would-be buyers were rejected. In about 2% of the cases, a subsequent background check was performed on the seller. The FBI says that indicates that the would-be buyer was ineligible and that the dealer wanted to make sure the seller could legally have the gun back. Now, you're saying it's not working. Sponsors say that the initiative is working because background checks are getting conducted on thousands of private gun sales a year.
Yeah, I mean, I would go back to the first sentence of that comment, you know, about not a single prosecution. And background checks, can be triggered for a variety of reasons. You could have a divorce order that can trigger a background check. And the other thing is I would point to most of the gun shootings that we've had in the United States. Most of them were not. They were in states that had background check laws. You know, like I say, I wish the best of luck to the people who are pursuing this, but if we look to other states for examples, it doesn't seem to have been a magic bullet in any way, and I can't point to any fruits from the bill that we passed here, but you know, I don't think it does any harm. It's an inconvenience to a few people who might be in a hurry, but you know, 3-day wait to get a gun is perfectly reasonable. But I think that if the Washington citizens are thinking, oh, if we can only implement these Obama or Inslee background checks, that gun violence in Washington is going to go away, I think that's not going to, they're going to be sorely disappointed.
I'd like to put this back in a more, on what Joni was saying, in a more social and historical perspective. I watched the CNN, the president speak last night on CNN, and I also, obviously everyone was talking about it. I watched this morning that the NRA was obviously absent and said it was a publicity stunt of why they would not attend the CNN with Anderson Cooper talking about, you know, what he wants to.
It was a town hall meeting type of format.
And I did have an opportunity to read the president's executive order on reducing gun violence and making our community safer. But I just want to go back to what Joni says, because I think, you know, she has this historical perspective, and I think she articulated it much better than me, but I'll try. In my generation, you know, gun violence is an epidemic, and I think we have to just accept that. The Second Amendment is, of course, it's one of our amendments. It's one of the 10, just like our First Amendment, we can't holler, you know, fire in a crowded theater. And no one's like,
you're saying there are limits on the free speech,
limits,
the First Amendment.
But let me just say this, and this may sound a bit provocative, and again, I'm still, you know, as a mother, just how I feel about guns, is that it is an epidemic, and like the AIDS crisis in the 90s, until it got in the suburbs, until it hit their communities, it wasn't an issue. And now that it's hitting the suburbs, we had 10 communities where the president was there with families, including the Naval Yard, where these were communities not of color, not inner city, that these were other communities that all of a sudden, I think lives mattered. And I think that's what I find offensive and painful as an American, is that it is an epidemic. It's been going on a long time, but until it hurt certain neighborhoods, even like with the drug issue, it became gentrified. And then it became an issue. Then it became a social problem. Now we have a problem. Well, we've always had a problem. We had problems with a lot of these issues, but until they hit particular neighborhoods or particular populations or particular groups with power and authority and a voice, nobody cared.
Well, First of all, I don't think you can say it's been ineffective. You don't know who was slowed, and you don't know who was prevented from buying a gun.
Talking about Washington State's background check law.
And more so, you know, I think it's ridiculous to say that, you know, that we should just completely just lay down and let's just do nothing, because it's,
exactly.
I mean, that's just ridiculous. And nobody is saying that background checks are the only step. That's not what people are saying. People are saying there's a many other things you should do. Do the research. Find out.
Just to be clear.
Repeat offenders that show up at Harborview. Some of the early research shows that if you are a victim of gun violence, you are likely to come back. So they're hitting it from a different way with this guns and ammunition tax. They're trying to say, hey, we're going to have case managers on your tail once you check, if you're lucky enough to check out of here from gun violence, that we're going to have case managers on your tail, and they're going to try to help you not come back with an even worse.
Right. And I'm not suggesting that we do nothing, but what I am suggesting is that we don't have a background check problem in America. What we have is a mental health problem in America, and I would much rather see money spent not on hiring police officers to sit in front of a computer doing paperwork on 99% of the people who are doing a legitimate gun transfer. I'd rather see that money spent on mental health.
What would you do about mental health?
Well, you know, we could put more mental health facilities in the schools, you know, or we could, you know, talk to these kids right where they're having problems. We could have, you know, more mental health available in, poor areas or wherever there's gun violence. But, you know,
you mean paying for therapists and,
right,
and
absolutely,
or drug pharmaceuticals?
I don't want to drug up every, you know, kid or anything. But when I look at these situations of gun violence in the United States, rarely do I find an example like, oh, this guy wouldn't have had a gun if there was a background check. But we do see a kid who is mentally ill, who had serious psychological problems. People knew that this person had psychological problems, but we just didn't have the resources to get him a counselor or to get him treatment. I just think that we our gun problem is not a paperwork problem. Our gun problem is a mental health problem.
I don't mind calling it a mental health problem if you take on the rest of it. It's not only a mental health. That becomes like this convenient thing. Oh, let's deal with the mental health system, which we haven't dealt with very well nationwide. There are some steps in our state, but we haven't dealt with it nationwide. So I think that's just too easy and too convenient. You got to deal with the guns, too.
Yeah.
And remember that most of the folks who go to our hospitals, these are accidents. These are suicides.
Right. Yep.
So you want to, if the gun isn't there, then the shooting doesn't happen.
And I think we also have to include, besides the mental health piece and the violence, and we could go on and on about all the other societal factors, is that, you know, there's a technology piece here. If we can have smartphones and smart TVs, I think we can have smart guns. And I know that the gun lobby has fought that, which I think is real disheartening. Like the president was saying, if a child can't open up a bottle of aspirin, why can't you have a gun where a child can't pull a trigger? Yeah, what is wrong with any of that?
Should we regulate guns like we regulate child safety caps and car seats? Representative, same thing?
Well, I think it might not be the best analogy, or, you know, in the sense that we don't use aspirin to defend our home from intruders. And so for those people who want a gun for self-protection, which the Supreme Court has held as a constitutional right, then maybe not having a cumbersome process to open up the gun and make it work would be in their interest. And I would see why they might object on those grounds.
We'll keep talking about this as we see what executive actions from the president, from Governor Inslee, and any other initiatives that might get proposed to this state and elsewhere as we talk about gun regulation and gun rights in this country. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review. We're talking about issues that were raised this week, some solutions too, with Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, Matt Manweller, Republican from Ellensburg, Deborah Juarez, new Seattle City Council member from D5, District 5 in North Seattle. So this week, a Republican state lawmaker in Washington moved to rein in the law about which bathroom a transgender person can use. Right now, transgender people can use public restrooms that align with the gender they identify with. Republican State Representative Graham Hunt of Pierce County wants to change that.
The policy that I'm working on right now is essentially saying that public or private entities are allowed to segregate their facilities by gender, such as a bathroom, a restroom, a toilet, shower, locker room, or sauna, to a person if they're preoperative, non-operative, or otherwise have genitalia that's different from which the facility they're entering. So I'm not saying that they're transgender or they're not transgender. What I'm saying is that if you have male parts, in terms of genitalia, then you should be using the men's room. If you have female parts, then you should be using, in terms of genitalia, you should be using the female's room. Now, once that's changed, so if you're post-operative and that's changed, not an issue. Utilize the facility for the gender that you have assigned. But the concern is regarding privacy and security. You know, there are folks that, quite frankly, would take advantage of this law. And I doubt that it's the transgender community that would do this. But there are folks that would take advantage of this law and utilize it in terms of voyeurism or utilize it for indecent exposure or who knows, which is why I think we need to have a broader conversation. And that's what my bill really is trying to do.
Another policy expert, Danny Aschini, disagrees. She heads the Gender Justice League in Seattle. She's a transgender woman, and she says this legislation doesn't solve a real problem.
I mean, I think it ignores a few things. One, which is that there are thousands of transgender people around the state right now who are using bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their gender identity, and that's been the case since the non-discrimination law was passed in 2006, so over a decade, largely without any incident or increased concerns about public safety. So this bill would strip all of those people, a majority of those people, of the rights that they currently enjoy.
Representative Hunt said that this bill is to address security, safety, and privacy concerns. What security, safety, and privacy concerns do you have about his bill passing?
Sure. So I think, you know, 53% of transgender people experience harassment or discrimination in places of public accommodation currently. So it is a huge, you know, concern for transgender people. And everybody agrees that everybody's concerned about security, safety, in public accommodation. But being forced, like I'm a transgender woman, if I was forced to use a men's locker room, I would be incredibly unsafe. You know, your listeners can't see me, but I think that they would also be uncomfortable with the idea of me being forced into a men's room. So it would expose transgender people to even more targeting and more violence than we already face.
Again, we're talking about a bill proposed in the state legislature. Representative Manweller, you can hear the dilemma over how people identify and where they can go. What do you think we should do?
I don't hear any dilemma at all. I hear this and I go, oh, my God, is this really an issue? you know, let's just I don't even know where to start on this absolutely insanity. Apparently, men have been able to use men's restrooms and women have been using women's restrooms and locker rooms for the last century. And we haven't had a problem. And all of a sudden, the Human Rights Commission decides to write a rule behind closed doors mandating that 40-year-olds can shower with my college students at Central Washington University, or that, you know, high school boys can go into the same locker room with the cheerleaders. I mean, good grief.
Are there group showers where
they're all group showers now. Apparently, you're not allowed to keep anybody out of a different shower. I mean,
well, the state law on this, the anti-discrimination law, has been around for almost a decade. Have you ever?
But it hasn't had any specificity with this type of silly rules. I mean, in this era when we are so concerned about sexual assault on college campuses, please tell me how it's going to make women safer to let a bunch of 40-year-old men go shower with 19-year-old college girls. This is insane.
Well, one more thing. I know you both want to talk. Well, I just because you asked, the person I talked to, Danny Aschini, said that she would feel unsafe under this proposal. And she said, if your listeners could see me, I think they would be uncomfortable with the idea of me being forced to use a men's locker room.
Right. So what we
you
should
asked
do
about safety.
Is we should make 99% of all other women uncomfortable so one other person can feel comfortable. Again, this is the idea of civil rights turned on its head. This Janny woman has been using male bathrooms since she was born, and she's obviously been doing fine doing that. But why should we allow men? I talk to some of my most liberal constituents, and let me tell you one thing liberal parents have in common with conservative parents. They both have daughters, and my liberal constituents do not want, you know, 40-year-old men showering with their college girls, and they do not want high school boys going and unzipping their pants in the same room that their daughters are unzipping their pants, and this is ridiculous.
Okay, so what I think here, and he's making some very good points, but he's also not distinguishing between, I think we're down to single stalls and multiple stalls here is what we're talking about. So take the city of Seattle, and they recently, and the mayor was talking about this, decided that all the single stall bathrooms in the city of Seattle would be gender neutral.
And that's fine.
And who cares?
Who cares?
Who cares? Now, when you get into the multiple stalls and you're talking about, as we said earlier, someone I was speaking with, we're talking about the end of the urinal here. Nobody wants what you just said.
No.
The group shower situation, and I certainly don't think that's what is even going on. So I disagree
but
that's even
law,
happening.
But this rule applies to Central Washington University
showers at the Central
Absolutely. We have locker rooms. We have athletic facilities.
And so the rule is applying in that way.
As written, it applies.
But that's not what's happening.
Deborah Juarez?
It happened December 26th. It's only 2 weeks old.
Well, I guess my concern is this. I haven't read the legislation. And if it is focusing in talking about security, safety, and privacy, I mean, I would be concerned about the security, safety, and privacy of anyone. I do want to say, though, that the protection of transgender people should be a real concern that we should be able to talk about openly and freely. I don't think we're talking about 40-year-old men showering with high school girls. I think right now we're just talking about a public accommodation. And I don't want this, I don't want to see a particular community marginalized. Kind of back to the, you know, colored restrooms or Jim Crow or dividing.
That is not this, though. We're not.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is let's at least have the discussion and let's at least be let's be open about having the discussion before we jump right to where you went, where you have 40-year-old men showering with girls.
This, let me ask you.
But no evidence thereof.
This law has been in effect for almost a decade. Deborah Juarez, have you ever felt unsafe because of the state's? You're a woman who goes into restrooms.
I'm a
and
man.
Joni, have you felt unsafe?
No, and I got 2 points to say to that. I have never felt unsafe. And one thing I learned when I was in Europe, and I used to wonder why we didn't have this in the States. In Europe, you have unisex bathrooms.
Yeah.
There's not a big deal. And I remember the first time I was there, I was like, oh, men and women. The stalls are
separate,
yeah,
though. It's not the open.
It's not a big deal.
Right.
So people need to just calm down. And now let's recognize that the transgender community is part of this conversation. Their safety is important, too. And so let's just have a reasonable conversation before we jump right to where the senator went.
So, and representative.
Oh, sorry.
I know, but I appreciate the promotion. but, you know, and again, I would say this is not Jim Crow laws. This is not segregation. This is traditional gender bifurcation that is part of just every culture in the world practically. And I would take exception. This law is not 6 years old. This rule was adopted by unelected bureaucrats, and it was published on December 26th, the day after Christmas, with the intention of hiding it from the public. It has been in effect for 2 weeks, but up until 2 weeks ago, every private entity, every school could say, hey, boys, you're not allowed in this locker room. Girls, you're not allowed in this locker room. And as of 2 weeks ago, the Human Rights Commission has said you cannot do that in your own private business, even your own private Christian religious school.
So are you now telling women to stay out of public restrooms? Because who knows who's in
anything.
There?
Well, I'm married.
No.
I know better than women what to do.
Are you concerned that now women's bathrooms are in the last 2 weeks are now unsafe? Don't go in there.
What I'm saying is it is creating an environment ripe for abuse. And I think that's what Representative Hunt was saying, is because as of 2 weeks ago, if a man started to walk into the UW women's locker room, an official at that school could say, sir, this is not your place. And now, if a man walks into the UW girls' locker room, they are not allowed to keep him out. He has every right to be there.
You mean a transgender woman?
I think what you need to see.
Any man who just says, I'm gender identity questioning, can walk in. I could walk in if I wanted to, and you can't stop me, and no, neither can anyone at UW without violating this new rule.
You offered an example, even though it's
I'm no expert. I'm not an expert enough on this rule, by the way, to
but
say anymore.
You offered
about
what an
it
example.
Says.
It's only been in effect for 2 weeks, and so we don't really have a real example. We just have this sort of fear of what might happen. Mm-hmm. And since it's been sort of happening anyway, with not anybody want to tell me about the big atrocity that happened in one of these?
Yeah.
Has not. So I think we should let it play out and see what it really looks like.
Okay. Well, we'll take a break there. And by the way, the discussion, since I don't think most people don't know a transgender person, the discussion gets a little harder when we don't have a transgender person here to talk about it. But I did do a conversation with Representative Hunt from Orting and with Danny Aschini from the Gender Justice League, who's transgender. And you can hear that conversation at our website, KUOW.org. And we're going to come right back to the Week in Review. We got one more topic in us this hour as we review the week's news. Deborah Juarez, City Council member, Matt Manweller, Republican State Representative, Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. This week, KUOW's Marcy Silman reported that Seattle's development and property value boom is driving musicians out of the city.
Not long after High Voltage opened its doors, the owners noticed a change in the neighborhood. As more construction cranes moved in, rents went up, and some of High Voltage's customers moved out. The final straw came when one of the buildings that housed rehearsal spaces, the Chop House, closed down.
The disappearance of the Chop House was probably the largest factor in a kind of direct factor in the demise of the High Voltage Music Store.
Even though High Voltage had a couple of years left on its lease, last summer Lomba and his partners decided to close their business. That decision doesn't surprise Matthew Richter. He tracks the ups and downs of cultural spaces for Seattle's Office of Arts and Culture. Richter says increased development has hit Seattle neighborhoods like a tidal wave.
I think there are neighborhoods where the wave has crashed, neighborhoods where the wave is actively crashing, and neighborhoods where you can see the wave coming. Pike Pine, I think that wave has crashed. I think that the undertow is in the process of pulling a lot of the affordability and a lot of the cultural footprint out of that neighborhood.
That's Marcy Silman reporting. Now, to some people, this is another example of Seattle losing its soul. If you listen to this show much, and I know you do, you've heard that complaint many times, as Seattle is gentrifying, booming, getting less affordable, et cetera. Seattle is losing its soul. So first we need to figure out what Seattle's soul is so we can decide whether and how to save it. Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter. What is Seattle's soul, and are we losing it?
Well, I think what these folks are referring to, you know, a lot of arts groups being able to be in your community, a lot of music groups being able to be born here and to flourish here, to not feel that they can't, you know, have a studio in the city or a performance at a local, should it be funky place that you drive to in the rain and park not too far away. Oh, my gosh, you wake up one day and tall, shiny, gleaming buildings have replaced all of this.
Okay, there's a lot going on there. There's arts groups that could practice in the city or out of the city. There's funky, rainy, tall, shiny. What is Seattle's soul?
Well, Seattle's soul's funky and rainy and sort of approachable.
Has it stopped raining? Actually, it did stop raining.
It stopped raining.
So maybe the drought was
hard to
example.
Notice. Yeah. But then take the traffic situation. Like one great difference between Seattle and many other big cities is, you know, say Los Angeles. Oh my gosh. You know, you can only do like two or three things in a day in Los Angeles because it takes so darn long to get everywhere.
Does that mean there's no soul in Los Angeles?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely no way. But
so soul is being able to drive fast. I want to know what soul is.
Is being able to get to these funky arts rainy places.
walking. So you have to walk to the funky places for it to have soul.
Deborah Juarez, what is Seattle's soul?
Well, soul to me, when I think of soul is jazz. And it's a feeling. And I read a couple articles about this, and like when we had that huge like grunge movement, remember? That was kind of what made us Seattle, Nirvana, and I don't know all these groups because I'm just going to be honest, that's not really what I listen to, but it's about—
So you have no soul family. Because you don't listen to grunge?
I have soul, but I'm more old school R&B, hip-hop. It doesn't matter what I like, but my issue is this. I keep saying this, that Seattle is a big city with big city problems, and we need to recognize that. We also need to embrace and just understand change is going to happen. Change is going to come. Isn't that a quote from some famous song?
Sam Cooke.
Exactly.
Get him on the line.
The other thing is one of the articles I read is some great bar in Shoreline, and I want to just make a big plug for our district in the north end. Is, you know, it doesn't all have to happen south of the Ship Canal. You have the south of the Ship Canal trance, that there is this big country north like City Way, Aurora, and all these great neighborhoods with really good bars that have open mic nights and have great jazz and music, and people just don't look north, and it's annoying.
So there's soul.
There's a lot of soul in the north end.
What does this even mean to you, Ellensburg representative?
I'm kind of smiling, laughing over here. You know, I know economics and constitutional pretty well, but constitutional law pretty well.
You're an economics professor.
Constitutional law professor.
Oh, constitutional law professor.
I never have professed to be an expert on the soul of Seattle. I think that what people like about Seattle, even if you're over from the red counties like I am, is that the soul is you can walk 10 blocks and cross a privately owned restaurant of 10 different ethnicities, you know, that mm-hmm. you can find... you walk 20 feet and run into 20 people from 20 different countries.
So soul is diversity.
Well, it's not just diversity. It's that hippie heart, you know, that you guys have, you know.
It's funky, is what it is.
I got a conservative ideology, but I have a hippie heart. I love
like
the 60s, right? You know?
Do you? You have a hippie heart?
Oh, my God. You do?
You know? It's like, let's go.
I didn't see
to
that hippie
Paul
heart in the bathroom.
I didn't see any hippie at all, buddy.
Let the hippie talk.
Yeah.
I'm going to pee by myself, but, you know, I'll drink.
I'm not going to come in there and scare you.
I'll drink one of your foo foo drinks as long as you let me pee in private.
No, you can't pee in private in Seattle.
You know, it's like Seattle is a vibrant place, but I think the councilwoman is absolutely right, is that you can't have it both ways. If you're going to be a high-tech magnet for the world and you're going to attract the greatest human capital from around the world and you're going to have these global, you know, Microsofts and Amazons, then you're going to have people move here and they're going to bring different demographics. And, you know, Seattle is some ways, I would say they're a victim of their own success. They're going to change because of their own success.
Yeah, I like that. Hippie soul.
Hippie
That's
soul.
The name of my next group.
He's hippieing on
my next garage band.
You know what? You know what? This is the sad part.
It's
the end of our hour. Oh, yes.
Man, can't we talk to him more? What's your name again?
Matt Manweller is
Matt
his name, Republican state representative from Ellensburg. Joni Balter, civic cocktail host on the Seattle Channel. Deborah Juarez, Seattle City Council member, repping North Seattle.
D5.
We're at KUOW when you tweet, and we're Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Go Seahawks.
Come on, go Seahawks.